And I majored in psychology in college and did advanced psych when I first went to medical school. But that's when I started meeting a bunch of psychiatrists. And some of my best friends are psychiatrists. And there's nothing wrong with psychiatrists, usually. But I did discover that my concept of psychiatry was wrong. You see, I had gleaned my concept of psychiatry from television. And it wasn't anything like that in reality. And young people, there's a message in that. You know, a lot of stuff that you see on television, it's not really very true to life. There's a big difference between the television screen and reality. You think about all the young people who go out playing basketball all the time. They think that they're going to make it to the NBA. See, they don't realize that only seven in 1 million will make it as a starter in the NBA. That means there are 999,993 out of a million who don't make it. Those aren't very good odds if you really sit down and think about it. They're not good odds if you do think about it. That's very bad. And the average career span is only 2.5 to 3.5 years in professional sports. And yet it's glamorized so much. Our young people think that it's the epitome of success in life. And most of those sports stars end up 5-10 years down the line out on the street again, looking for something to do because they didn't develop themselves when they were in college. It's not really very glamorous. And you look at the entertainers and all the glamour that surrounds entertainment. But most people don't realize that only 1 in 10,000 will make it in a big way in the field of entertainment. And most people don't realize that 10 to 15 years down the line, most of those people spend most of their time in smoke-filled nightclubs trying to get people to remember who they are. It's not really a very glamorous life at all. Television doesn't tell you about that part, though. And it's doing this country a very, very big disservice. Most people don't recognize that vis-a-vis all the other industrialized countries in the world, right now the United States ranks dead last in science and math, as far as our young people are concerned. And sometimes we don't get too excited when we hear things like that. We say, well, we're doing all right. I mean, isn't this like the richest and most prosperous country in the world? No, it isn't. No, not anymore. And it's rapidly going downhill vis-a-vis a lot of the other countries in the world. And the reason is we're not spending time concentrating on the right things. It's going to be up to the young people in this country to turn that trend around. The adults, I think, have lost their senses or something. I'm not sure what's wrong with them. But you look at the paralysis that exists in the government. People who can't even pass a budget. So how are they going to figure out how to turn around the educational situation? These are individuals who come up with a budget that's supposed to save $450 billion over a 5-year period when the deficit is increasing at over $300 billion a year. If you multiply that by 5, that comes out to 1.5, right? Not 0.45. So they never even learn how to do mathematics themselves. So how are they going to be able to solve those problems? And that's why young people today have to start concentrating on technical things, on science, on math, on all kinds of academic subjects so that they will be able to compete in a world that is becoming ever more complex. In a survey that was taken 2 years ago, looking at the ability of 8th graders to do mathematical problems, in 13 industrialized countries, the South Koreans were number one. 78% of their students could solve the problems. Japanese were number two. And the United States was last. Only 40% of our students, cross-section, across the country, could solve these problems. It's what I call the silent killer. It's like termites. Ignorance is like termites. Because you don't necessarily realize what it's doing until one day you walk out on the floor and your foot goes through. And then it's too late to do anything about it. You need to start thinking about that now.
Well, at any rate, I knew I didn't want to be a psychiatrist. So I had to ask myself, what then do I want to do with my life? It was a moment to stop and reflect on the talents that God had given me. I said, well, He's given me a lot of interest in the brain, and I knew I had a lot of eye-hand coordination and the ability to think three-dimensionally and a good memory, and I loved to dissect things. I was always dissecting things when I was a kid. And I remember when I was a youngster, before we became vegetarians, my mother used to tell me I couldn't eat at the table with everybody else because I always had my knife and fork out and I was dissecting out the little nerves and vessels out of the meat, putting them in a pile because I didn't want to eat them. So I had significant dissecting skills. So I put all that together and it came out, brain surgery. Why don't you become a brain surgeon? So once I made that decision, I said, well, if I'm going to train as a neurosurgeon, I should go to the place that is best known for neurosurgery. Well, that was Johns Hopkins. Harvey Cushing and Walter Dandy and A. Earl Walker and all these big names in neurosurgery had been at Johns Hopkins. So I said, I'm going to apply there. Well, unfortunately, they only took 2 people a year in the neurosurgery program out of 125 applicants. So it wasn't going to be an easy task. But I went anyway. And I should mention the fact that I never did get to be a contestant on College Ball, because the year I went to college, it went off the air. But I maintained that interest in classical music all that time. And interestingly enough, when I went for my interview at Johns Hopkins, the fellow who was in charge of selecting the residents was a tremendous classical music buff. So we talked a little bit about medicine, a little bit about neurosurgery. Suddenly the conversation turned to classical music. And we talked for over an hour about different conductors and composers and their styles and the various orchestras and orchestral halls. And the guy was on cloud 9. And there was no way he wasn't taking me into the program, because he had to have somebody to discuss these things with. And you know something? God knew I wasn't going to be on College Ball. But He knew that the day would come when I would need to have that extra edge. So He made sure that I got interested in classical music. You know, it's funny the way the Lord works. And sometimes we don't quite understand why various things are happening. But the interesting thing is, He knows. He knows the future. And all you have to do is trust in Him. But there's another very important point, young people, that I want to make here. You know, when I was a youngster, I was criticized for listening to classical music. People called me names, said I was trying to be white, this and that and the other, said that this was not culturally relevant. Let me tell you something about culturally relevant. If you want to influence the people in your house, then you just need to know what's relevant to the people in your house. If you want to influence the people in your community, you need to know what's relevant to the people in your community. If you want to influence the people of the world, you need to know what's relevant to the people of the world. And that does not bear any color or ethnicity or socioeconomic group. God has given everybody tremendous intellectual capacity. He's made some people look a little different. I think God has a good sense of humor. And also, you know, He doesn't like things to be boring. I mean, can you imagine how boring it would be if everybody looked exactly alike? First of all, you'd have a hard time recognizing people. So He knew what He was doing. But He also knew that one of the ways that He would be able to determine if people had His love in their heart
is whether they could look at somebody who looked a little different and still see God in them. And you know, people who can't do that, I think, have a very, very major problem deciding that they have a significant relationship with God. Because he has said, how can you love me who you have not seen when you don't love your brother who you have seen? And I think those are heavy, heavy words for everybody from every place. Something to think about. And remember what I said earlier. Don't say, yeah, Bob's like that. Think about yourself. Everything that I say. Well, at any rate, I started my residency at Johns Hopkins and things were going extremely well for me, and they continued to go well. And I remember in 1982 we had the grand opening of the Neuroscience Center at Johns Hopkins. And this was a real big affair, and all the big-wig neurosurgeons from every place around the world were there, because Hopkins is sort of the modern birthplace for neurosurgery. And I remember one of the fellows from Australia, who was a big-wig over there, took a liking to me. I was chief resident at the time. He said, why don't you come to Western Australia and be our senior registrar at our major teaching hospital? And I said, Australia, you got to be kidding me. I mean, I really kind of poo-pooed the whole idea, didn't think very much of it. Because for one thing, Australia is on the other side of the world. And for another thing, I had heard all kind of horrible things about Australia, that they really didn't appreciate non-white people over there. They had a whites-only policy, etc. So I kind of dismissed the whole thing. But it seemed like after I dismissed it, every time I turned around, there was someone behind me saying, good eye, mate, how you going? I just kept running into Australians everywhere. And they seemed like nice people. And every time we turned the TV on, there was a special on about Australia. So I said to my wife, I think the Lord wants us to go to Australia. So she went to the library and got a bunch of books on Australia, and we started reading. And it seemed like a really neat place to go. And we discovered they did have a whites-only policy, but it was an unofficial policy and had been officially abolished in 1968. And this was 1982-83. So we packed up all of our earthly belongings, sold everything else, and off we went to Australia. And our friends were saying, you'll be back in 2 weeks. But little did they know, we didn't have any more money, so we couldn't come back. So we were going to be there no matter what. Well, you know, it turned out that the biggest problem we had when we got to Australia was keeping up with all the dinner invitations. People were just so friendly. We were having a time of our lives. The second biggest problem was every time I sat down to look at a chart or to do something, someone would walk up to me and they would say, can I feel your hair? You know, they'd seen it on TV and in magazines. Here was their chance to actually feel the stuff, you know. So I would always say, you can feel it, but it's going to cost you $10. Figured I could get something out of the deal. But I would always tell them I could never remember their names because they all looked alike. So I was having a great time, though. And I remember the first week I was there, there was a young woman, and she had a very large tumor called an acoustic neuroma at the base of the skull. And this one was so big that the consultant neurosurgeon said, we will probably just be able to debulk this thing and perhaps save her life, but I don't think we'll be able to spare the cranial nerves. And I said, well, do you mind if I try with the microscope to do a microdissection and see if I can save the nerves? And he said, oh, go right ahead, young whippersnapper. I know that's what he was thinking. But, you know, I sat down there and it took 10 hours, but I got that tumor completely out and saved those nerves. And that young woman did so well, and she had a baby not too long thereafter. And she named it after the consultant who she thought had taken the tumor out. Well, that opened up a lot of doors for me, though, because the consultants, there were only four of them in Western Australia. They all said, well, Carson can do these cases. So they kind of left me there at the major teaching hospital to do most of the major cases while they went out to the peripheral hospital and did the peripheral nerves and the backs and necks and things like that. As a result of that, I was doing two or three craniotomies every day. Got a tremendous amount of experience, 5 to 10 years worth of experience doing complex cases in 1 year. So that when I returned to Johns Hopkins and joined the faculty in 1984, it wasn't long before people were able to see that my skills far exceeded my age. So that when the position of director of pediatric neurosurgery came open, instead of them going out and getting somebody with a lot of gray hair and a big name, they said, Carson can do all this stuff. Let's make him chief of pediatric neurosurgery. So there I was at age 33, chief of pediatric neurosurgery at a major tertiary referral center. And people would come great, great distances with their sick children to see Dr. Carson, chief of pediatric neurosurgery. And I would walk in the room and they would say, when's Dr. Carson coming? Because it couldn't possibly be me. I was clearly the medical student. And then I would say, well, I'm Dr. Carson. And they'd just about fall out of their chairs and have a seizure, which is how I got interested in doing seizure surgery. But it was interesting, the reactions. I used to have the greatest time going to the clinic and seeing the reactions of people. But I remember one of the cases that really profoundly affected me, and it was still very early in my career. It's a little boy from Georgia. And this was a family who had wanted a little boy for a long time, and they finally had one. But at age 4, this bright little fellow, who was already reciting Bible verses, started stuttering, started having double vision, his eyes started crossing, started having difficulty handling his secretions, started stumbling. And at first, doctors thought he had some type of a viral encephalitis. But as they studied him more and as he continued to deteriorate, they discovered he had a big, ugly tumor at the base of his brain. The area of the brainstem was completely replaced by this big ugly tumor. And they sent him off to the university hospitals, and the proclamations were made that this was a malignant tumor of the brainstem and that there was nothing that could be done. And the parents were told to take that boy home to keep him comfortable and let him die in peace. Well, they weren't willing to accept that. And they started going all over the place. They even went to faith healers. They saw Jim and Tammy. They saw everybody. Nobody could do anything for them. But eventually, they put that little boy on an airplane and they brought him to Baltimore. And I saw him when he rolled into that ward on that stretcher. And he was barely moving, barely breathing. His eyes were looking in different directions. He was frothing at the mouth. And I said, what am I supposed to do with this child? And the parents approached me and they said, Doctor, the Lord impressed us to bring our little boy here because we would find a Christian neurosurgeon who could do something. And I said, well, let me see the scans. I looked at the scans. And I said, this looks like a tumor of the brainstem. There's nothing we can do about this. And they said, but doctor, the Lord is going to heal our son. And he's going to use you to do it. And I said, well, I don't really see what I can do here, but let me take these x-rays to the radiologist. So I took them to the neuroradiologist and they studied them and they said, looks like a brainstem tumor. There's nothing to be done about this. And I said, well, Would you guys mind doing an MRI scan? That's a magnetic resonance imaging scan. It uses proton excitation to give you an image. And they did a CAT scan. They did it in lots of different orientations. And they came back with all this data. And they said, looks the same. Looks like a malignant tumor of the brainstem. There's nothing that can be done about this. So I went back and I told the parents. And they said, but doctor, the Lord is going to heal our son. And he's going to use you to do it. Well, I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I will go in and I will take a piece of the tumor. I will do a biopsy. We'll look at it under the microscope and analyze it. And maybe we can come up with a chemotherapeutic or radiation therapeutic protocol that will prolong your son's miserable life for a month or two. And they said, doctor, anything, anything. So I went in and uncovered the area of the brainstem, and I saw this big grayish-red ugly mass, and I took a biopsy and sent it off to the pathologist, and it came back malignant astrocytoma. Not unexpected at all. I said, well, while we're here, let's just remove as much as we can. So we started removing tumor until we started running across the important cranial nerves and blood vessels, and I said, it's time to stop. And I went out after we closed up and started talking to the parents, and I said, you know, only the Lord knows the beginning from the end. And I said, your son may have already served his purpose in life. We don't know why he is going to be given such a short period of time. But we just have to trust in the wisdom of the Lord. And I started telling them all of these things that we usually tell people when somebody is dying. You all know the whole spiel, I'm sure. And as I was about to leave, they said, doctor, thank you so much. The Lord's going to heal our son. And I walked away thinking how admirable their faith was. But I fully expected over the ensuing days that that boy would get worse and would die. But you know, over the ensuing days, that boy's eyes became conjugate. They started looking in the same direction. And he started moving more. He started breathing more deeply. We started wondering what's going on here. I said, we better get another scan. And, you know, the tumor was still there. But way up in the corner, I could see what looked like a little ribbon of brainstem. And I said, is it possible that maybe this thing is not in the brainstem, but is actually smashing the brainstem? And I said, maybe we should go back in there. And I explained all this to the parents, and of course they were elated. I went back in there and operated under the microscope for several hours, pulling tumor out of every crack and crevice. And eventually, I saw it, the brainstem. It was intact. It had been flattened and pushed out of the way. It came back into position. And you know, 3 weeks later, that boy walked out of the hospital, completely normal. I got a picture from him about a month ago, and he is doing extremely well. Never required any chemotherapy or radiation, and is completely normal neurologically at this time. Well, one of the oncologists came up to me subsequently, and he said, you know, I used to be an atheist, but after that episode, I am now a believer in God. And you know, that was a powerful witness for him. But you know, it was even a more powerful witness for me, because up until that time, I used to give lip service, like we all do, to having a relationship with God and praying before an operation. But you know, I really thought that I was doing most of it. I said, you know, I have a degree from Yale, from the University of Michigan. I train at Johns Hopkins. I've been a fellow in Australia. I'm the chief of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins. I'm only 33. I said, I am a tough dude. But you know, after that, I realized where the power was really coming from. I realized that it was God who was really behind it all. And it became clear to me that if I was willing to trust in the Lord with all my heart and lean not to my own understanding, and in all my ways acknowledge Him, that He would direct my paths, and that it would be possible to do many things far beyond what I or anyone else imagined if I was simply willing to step aside and let God take over. I was willing to become the assistant at that point and turn the scalpel over to Him in my life. And that's when things really started to happen. I started getting all kinds of unusual cases. I remember there was a case of a young woman who was discovered to have twins, intrauterine. One of them had severe hydrocephalus. His head was growing very rapidly to the point that the uterus was expanding so quickly that it looked like she would go into premature labor and both of the babies would be born before their lungs had matured to the point where they could survive. And the obstetrician approached me, knowing that I did daring things, and said, would it be possible for you to put a shunt into that hydrocephalic baby while he's still in the mother's womb? Well, interestingly enough, there had been some experimental surgery trying to put shunts into hydrocephalic lambs. And there had been an article in a New England Journal of Medicine just 3 weeks before that incident decrying the use of this technology because of the horrible results and saying that we just weren't ready for it yet. And yet here was a situation where both children, one normal and one with hydrocephalus, might be lost if we didn't do anything. So, of course, I prayed and asked God what should be done. Felt impressed that we should go ahead, so we started working on it quickly. And actually, with the use of ultrasound and some cannulas and some of the obstetric equipment, we were able to puncture the uterus, and watching ourselves on the ultrasonic scope, we were able to insert the tube into the baby's brain, and we could see the head shrinking right there on the screen. And that gave them a number more weeks for their lungs to mature. And then finally the two babies were delivered. And of course, it hit the media at that point, and it was a big, big story that night, all over the national news and all over the newspapers and magazines. And a lot of people were criticizing, and they were saying this was unethical and it was too dangerous, etc. That is, until it became clear that not only the normal baby, but even the hydrocephalic baby was doing well. At which time, all the same critics said, well, under those circumstances, I would have done that too. Now, everybody jumps on the bandwagon in that kind of situation. But the thing that I was thinking about is, what would happen if you don't do anything? And if the answer is something worse than what would happen if you do something, then it's probably worth taking the chance. And see, one of the reasons that I'm willing to take chances sometimes is because I know the Lord is there. If you know the Lord is behind you, you don't have to worry too much. I remember another case of a young girl from New Mexico. And she was in status epilepticus. That means she was having constant seizures. And she had been in status for 2 solid months. There wasn't 1 hour, 1 minute, 1 second in which she wasn't having a seizure for 2 solid months. She had to be on a respirator because she couldn't breathe for herself. She was paralyzed on one side, hadn't spoken for several months. And she had been to see lots of different specialists around the country. The seizures were all coming from the dominant hemisphere. No one thought there was anything that could be done about it. Well, this mother was a person who was very determined. She finally said, She heard about some of the work we were doing at Hopkins, made arrangements for the child to be transferred up there for an evaluation. And myself and some of my colleagues felt that she was a candidate for a left cerebral hemispherectomy, removing the left half of her brain to control these seizures. And there was another very famous neurologist who led another faction that said, no, she was not a candidate for this. And he was very adamant about it, went to the point of writing letters to the hospital president and the dean and the departmental chairman saying, you cannot let Carson operate on this patient because she's already been seen in several other places and everybody has determined that she is not a candidate for any type of surgery and she will do poorly and we will look like loose cannons and it will be a blight upon the name of this institution. And a little battle ensued, and then he made a big mistake. He decided to go to a conference, and the conference was in Rome, and he left a patient there in the hospital. And I said, now, this is our big chance. So we took the patient to the operating room and took out the left half of her brain. And you know, when he came back from Rome, she was no longer on the respirator. She was no longer having seizures. She was starting to move the side that had been paralyzed before. And she went on to make an excellent recovery. And you know something? That guy never has anything negative to say anymore. And you know, that opened up a lot of doors for me, that particular incident. People stopped questioning some of the relatively radical things that I was talking about doing at that point. But you know, the reason I was willing to take that kind of a chance is because I recognize that God will never get me into anything that He can't get me out of. And if you trust in Him, and if you have developed your intellect to its fullest, and then you allow Him to do the rest, and you acknowledge Him as the source of your power, you really don't have to worry about anything. As long as He has given you the wisdom and the ability to take care of that particular problem. Well, I started having lots of other episodes. I remember one little girl that I had done a hemispherectomy on, and this was a very complex situation. But she stayed in a coma for a month after the hemispherectomy. But finally she started waking up. And then they were worried about her going back to school. They were saying, with only half of her brain and the left half was missing, how would she be able to do math? How would she be able to calculate? But the little girl had so much determination that the next year she had the highest mathematics average in her fifth grade class with only half of a brain. Now, if she can do that with half of a brain and some determination, young people, you have to ask yourself, what can you do with a whole brain and determination and the power of God behind you? The human brain is an amazing, amazing organ system, the most complex computer in the universe. How many people here remember what they had for lunch today? Quite a few, quite a few. And it didn't take you very long to remember. And yet, what did your brain have to do for you to remember that? Think about this. First of all, the sound waves had to travel through the air, impinge upon your external auditory meatus, impinge upon your tympanic membrane, known as your eardrum, set up a vibratory force, which was transmitted to the ossicles, the little bones in your ear, which then transmitted a force to the oval and round windows, which transmitted mechanical energy to the endolymph, which mechanically distorted the microcilia in the inner ear, which transformed the mechanical energy to electrical energy, which then traveled across your cochlear nerve to the cochlear nuclei at the pontomedullary junction, and then bilaterally ascended the brainstem to the medial geniculate nuclei, and then radiated across the thalamic nuclei into the posterior portions of the temporal lobe, transferred forward to the frontal lobes, down the tract of Victor Jour to retrieve the memory from the mammillary bodies and the parahippocampal formations, back to the frontal lobes, to the precentral gyrus to start the motor response in the Bett cells, coming down the cortical spinal tract, across the cerebral peduncles into the brainstem, across the decussation at the cervical medullary junction into the spinal cord gray matter, out the ramus into the neuromuscular junction, stimulating the nerves and muscles so you could raise your hand. Now, that was the simplified version. I didn't want to talk about all the inhibitory forces from the cerebellum and the basal ganglia and red nuclei because things would start to get complex then. But if you can do all of that without barely thinking about it, can you imagine what you can do if you really put your mind to it? There is no such thing as an average human being. Anybody who's got 14 billion cells and connections is not average. And the fact of the matter is, God didn't give you that much firepower just to hold your ears apart. He expected you to do something with it, quite frankly. And it's just a matter, I think, of thinking big. Think big. And I'm going to close by telling you what that means. The T is for talent, which God has given to every single person. And I'm not just talking about the ability to sing or to throw a ball. Those are talents too. But I'm also talking about intellectual abilities, mathematics and computers, the ability to extract complex thoughts from the written page. We all have these kinds of abilities, some more than others. Lord expects you to develop those as young people. And He expects you to choose careers that will allow you to use your intellectual talents. And if you choose careers where He has given you talent, you will excel in those areas. Remember I told you how I stopped and thought about the talents that God had given me? And that's how I chose neurosurgery? It's just a matter of sometimes stopping for a minute, thinking about where you are and where you're going. And you can make a much wiser choice when you do things that way. The H is for honesty. If you lead a clean and honest life, you don't have to worry about what you said 3 months ago. You don't have to try to remember it. You just tell the truth all the time. And if you don't put skeletons in the closet, they won't come back out to get you later on. The I is for insight, which is gained by listening to people who have already gone where you're trying to go. You can learn from their mistakes. You can learn from their triumphs. And you can move much further, much faster, if you can learn from other people. The N is for nice. Because if you're nice to people, once they get over their suspicion of why you're being nice, they'll be nice to you. And you'll get a lot more things done that way. The K is for knowledge. Knowledge is the key that unlocks all the doors. Knowledge is the thing that makes you valuable. It really doesn't matter where you came from or what you look like. If you have the knowledge, then all of a sudden you become very, very valuable. My mother used to tell me when I was a youngster, she said, you know, if you walk into an auditorium full of racist, bigoted people, she said, you don't have a problem. She says, they have a problem. She says, because when you walk in there, they're all worrying about whether you're going to sit next to them, and you can sit anywhere you want. So let them worry about it. You know, you got to think like that. You know, you can't worry about things that you can't change. But you can. There's one thing you can change. You can make yourself valuable with knowledge. And the B is for books, which is the mechanism whereby that knowledge is obtained. Not television. Average young person in this country looks at over 18,000 hours of television by the time they're 18 years old. There's only 8,760 hours in a year, just to put that into perspective for you. The I is for in-depth learning. Learning things for the sake of knowledge and understanding. Not for the sake of taking an exam. Not for the sake of impressing people. But so that you have an understanding of the material, so that you can present it simply to someone else. You know, there is nothing intellectual about going before a group of individuals and speaking in terms that few people can understand. Real intellect means you can break the material down so that everybody can understand it. And there is nothing erudite and wonderful about throwing around fancy terms and eloquent sentences. What's important is being able to communicate with people and asking God to give you the wisdom and the ability to understand material to the point that you can break it down for somebody else to understand. And the G is for God. Proverbs 16:3 says, "Commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts shall be established." This is the kind of thing that we have to think about. And I should mention before I close that my mother did teach herself how to read eventually, once my brother and I were on our way. And she went on and got her GED and went on to college, became an interior decorator. And in fact, she's out there. Mother, could you stand up so they can see you? And my wife and three sons are out there as well. But last thing I want to say, a phrase to keep in mind, young people. You know, God is still alive and active today. And those stories that we read about that I mentioned early in the Bible, He can still do that kind of thing today. And the thing that is important is not where you came from, but it's where you're going.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.